It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, thanks to the cocktail craze, bitters abound. Yes, they're delicious. But according to the aptly named Mark Bitterman, author of Bitterman's Field Guide to Bitters and Amari, they can be even more delicious when deployed outside the highball glass.
I actually use bitters as a way to add flavor complexity into dishes that might otherwise lack it. So I might just put a dash or two in a sauce. I'll put a grapefruit bitters, for example, maybe in a salad dressing. I'll put a fruitier bitters in a dessert like whipped cream or you name it. So it's actually a wonderful way to add a little bit of complexity. And sometimes it's fun to have this little unexpected note of bitterness.
The nuance of bitters and breaking bread over Kalashnikovs. This hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Right beside the craft cocktail explosion is the rebirth of the cocktail's essential sidekick, a new world of craft bitters. These little bottles bring the exclamation point to drinks. Some nip, some purr, some sweeten, and the varieties keep coming. Mark Bitterman, who has the Meadow Shops in Portland, Oregon and New York City, does in-depth studies on singular foods. Salt and chocolate are on his backlist. Now he's written Bitterman's Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. Melissa Clark got the story.
Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Melissa.
It used to be that there was one or two kinds of bitters in the supermarket, and now there's an explosion. What's with the bitters? Why are there so many available?
I think it's really an offshoot of the craft cocktail movement. I think probably the most vibrant thing happening in food today in America is cocktails, really. And bitters are a reflection of that. They're kind of the salt, if you will, of a cocktail. So as cocktails have become more important, bitters have come back to the fore.
So what exactly are bitters?
They're an alcohol-based flavor extract. So you take any kind of botanical, it could be anything from roots to barks to berries to leaves to stems, and you macerate them in alcohol. You basically soak them in alcohol, and that pulls a bunch of the aromatic qualities of those botanicals out. And then you add some form of bittering agent. Could be gentian or wormwood is one that people have heard of, and you give it kind of a bitter core to its flavor. And that's all a bitter is. It's an alcohol-based flavor extract with a bitter foundation of flavor.
But Mark, bitters aren't just bitter. They have other flavors.
Absolutely. And actually, I'm just flipping through the book right here because I created sort of a taxonomy of the different types of flavors that there are. The most common is aromatic, which is sort of a complex bouquet of a lot of spicy kind of baking spice flavors. There's also citrus. Fruit is another option. So you just imagine anything from pear to cherry. Another is spice, so something that might have kind of a really, really intense nutmeg or clove or cinnamon. There's spicy bitters, which have a lot of piquancy, a lot of capsaicin buzz, just like chili peppers. Then you've got herbal floral bitters. And the last would be nut, which I would include maybe chocolate and coffee, walnut, almond, things like that.
Wow, that's quite a range. Now, you call your book A Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. What's the difference between a bitter and amaro?
So, yeah, amari is just the word amaro in plural. So bitters and amari are effectively the same thing. The difference is that bitters are designed to be put into drinks by the drop, and amari are designed to be drunk straight up or used as a mixer. So amari are basically more potable or more drinkable bitters. But historically, they were the same thing.
So an example of bitters would be Angostura. And what's an example of an Amaro? Is Campari an Amaro?
Absolutely. Campari is an Amaro. Another really well-known one might be Fernet.
Ah, yes.
There are many, many, many hundreds of them all around the world. But those are probably two of the best-known ones.
So I was reading in your book that at one point there were no bitters. There was just Amari. And then bitters kind of evolved from Amari. Is that – can you tell us that story?
So historically, they're really the same thing. Amaro is just the Italian word for bitters. And in America, we had many, many, many kinds of bitters, which were just these drinkable, basically medicines. You take all these botanicals that had all these medicinal properties, and people would make the bitters out of it and then drink it as medicine. And that evolved to the point where there were thousands of these crazy patent medicines all over America. And eventually what happened was the U.S. government kind of said, hey, we've had it. We're going to have to establish some standards. And they passed the Safe Food and Drugs Act of 1906 and effectively said that you have to now list all the ingredients that are in bitters and you have to make claims about what they can do that are legit. And almost overnight, all the bitters makers went away. With prohibition, some years later, things got even worse. The government said that now anything that's an alcoholic beverage is not allowed. And so all the bitters makers that had managed to survive the Act of 1906 then pretty much went belly up. One or two exceptions did make it, and the most known of them is Angostura. And they survived really because they're incredibly litigious, hard-fighting, hard-hitting company that just wouldn't say no. And they actually convinced the government that it couldn't be drunk. It was just useful as a flavoring and maybe even for medicinal reasons. And so they were able to survive.
Now, most people think bitters go in cocktails, but you also use them in cooking.
Yeah, I think, you know, I like to take shortcuts when I cook. I've got two kids and I run a business and I don't want to always make everything as complicated as possible. So I actually use bitters as a way to add flavor complexity into dishes that might otherwise lack it. So I might just put a dash or two in a sauce. I'll put a grapefruit bitters, for example, maybe in a salad dressing. I'll put a fruitier bitters in a dessert like whipped cream or you name it. So it's actually a wonderful way to add a little bit of complexity, some kind of unusual different flavors. And sometimes it's fun to have this little unexpected note of bitterness. So just like you eat radicchio, adding bitterness to your salad dressing adds a little bit of extra bitterness to it. It's delicious.
If you were going to direct me to just buying a couple of bitters, what are the indispensable ones? What do I need to own?
That's always hard. And I'm always supposed to be prepared for that question because people ask me that every day. It's hard because, yeah, they are all of my children and I love them and I can't see life without 50. but I think that you could pare it down to three. Probably my favorite, most versatile bitters is an aromatic bitters. So there are several families of bitters, aromatic and citrus and floral. And having an aromatic bitters, Angostura is an example of aromatic bitters. But Angostura, I find, has really strong, pronounced flavors of clove and cinnamon, and it's really a dominant note in drinks very quickly. And so I personally prefer an aromatic bitters called Boker's. It's clean and bright and kind of more of like a sharp, more well-defined aromatic bitters than Angostura. Both are fantastic, but that's my favorite. So I recommend a Boker's bitters to everybody because you can make all your old fashions and your Manhattans and even add some to your Negroni. And you've got to have a citrus bitters. So that you can pick your poison, if you will. The most well-known variety out there is Gary Regan's. It's called Regan's Orange Bitters. And that's an awesome product. And it's not very expensive either. But any orange bitters that you can get your hands on, I would buy that. And the good news is that most makers do a good job with the orange bitters.
And then something floral, perhaps?
You read my mind. So absolutely. I love to bring a floral dimension into cocktails. One of the things I think is very difficult to get away with in food is lavender. But in a cocktail, you can actually pull it off. So I use a lavender bitters as a sneaky little note in some cocktails, not even announcing that it's there. And in other cocktails, I make it actually more of a centerpiece. So I'd recommend a lavender or other floral bitters.
Mark, this is fascinating. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. It's been a blast.
Mark Bitterman is author of Bitterman's Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. Melissa Clark is author of the forthcoming Dinner, Changing the Game. Now, Mark left us with two recipes to get us started. One for bitter buttered popcorn and a tangerine fennel salad with bitter celery vinaigrette. You can find them all at splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern have been writing about local eating nonstop since the 1970s. Now, the world has changed, but not their devotion or their uncanny instincts for discovery. With more than 30 books between them and a website, roadfood.com, they keep us all up to date on what and where to eat in America. Jane, Michael, welcome.
Hey, Len.
Hey, Len. So where have you two been? What is the latest?
Well, we've been at a place called The Cupboard, which is in Memphis, Tennessee, and it's really just down the road from Graceland, which is, of course, a great location. Now, if I tell you this is another classic meat and three place, you'll say, oh, my God, this is all the Sterns talk about when they talk about Southern food. But in fact, meat and threes are starting to get harder and harder to find. The classic meat and three is you have a piece of, let's say, fried chicken.
Right.
And then you have turnip greens, candied yams.
Crowder peas, onions, cabbage, sweet potatoes.
Right. A choice of maybe 12 vegetables followed by a wonderful piece of homemade cream pie. And for years, we always thought, well, this is the South. It will never go away. Southerners are the last people to have a hot meal for lunch and like sit down and have a hot meal followed with dessert. But, you know, these places are getting harder to find. So The Cupboard is really a place to be applauded for holding the line.
And one of the reasons it's really great is that the proprietor, Charles Cavallo, is a vegetable fanatic. I mean, he actually grew up. His father sold vegetables. As a kid, he used to sell watermelon. He used to sell vegetables by the side of the road. And when he opened this restaurant, I mean, it is meat and three, but it's the three. It's the vegetable part of the menu that is really the focus. In fact, when you walk in, there are, you know, plenty of booths and tables. And among the booths and tables in the aisles are piles of squash, watermelons, whatever's fresh from the market at that particular time.
Yeah, I think the tomatoes came directly from Ripley, which is the town next door, and the squashes were from somebody's garden. I mean, you know.
And people do come in to buy vegetables by the peck and bushel as well as to eat a meal here.
So right. It's the local thing, but the local thing with the old tradition of the meat and three.
Exactly.
It's organic, sustainable, artisanal.
All those good things.
All the buzzwords, but with also just good old meat and three and cream pies for dessert.
And great cream pies. The lemon icebox pie, you know, which is a real Southern thing, is one of those. On a hot day, there is nothing more refreshing than a slice of lemon icebox pie.
Oh, gosh. Okay, guys. Sounds great.
All right.
Thank you.
Happy eating.
Bye, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael Stern's picks at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, get registered for this month's giveaway, a 10-piece set of Ballerini nonstick cookware from Italy. There will be 14 winners. So get the details at splendidtable.org. Coming up, breaking bread in a war zone and reality strikes the homemade kitchen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Journalist Anna Bodkin covers wars. She spent years embedded in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. She's picked her way through minefields. She's been held at gunpoint and experienced what it's like to have a $50,000 price on her head, thanks to the Taliban. But she's not a sentimentalist. Yet the book she chose to write is called Piecemeals, Candy-Wrapped Kalashnikovs and Other War Stories. Anna, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You know, at first glance, a book about food and war reporting, of all things, it seems really odd. Can you explain the link for us?
You know, Lynn, I think that the way we're all united, people here in the United States and people in the most direst of a failed state, is by the common need we have to eat. At the end of the day, if we're lucky, we're going to have something to eat. And the idea was to take the reader beyond the Bang Bang that we see plenty of on television and mm-hmm. in newspapers, and talk about the very, very humane stories that continue to happen in any place. People continue to fall in love. They fall out of love. They quarrel. They have babies. They get married. Because I felt the need to explain to people who are so far removed from war zones that people on the other side are very much like them, so that they're able to connect. And next time they see a firefight on television or a bomb going off, they can imagine the people on the other side who are living in that.
You know, there's something I'd love to have you read from the book, and it's the beginning of a particular chapter, Candy-Wrapped Kalashnikovs. Could you read the beginning of that for us?
Sure. It's the beginning of chapter 4. High on Valium and potent Afghan hashish, Najibullah balanced his Kalashnikov rifle on his left shoulder and reached for the jalebi, a pyramid of honey-colored deep-fried rings of hot, syrupy dough stacked on a street vendor's dusty aluminum folding table by the side of a potholed dirt road. He hooked one jalebi with his long index finger, raised it above his head, lifted his bearded face, and, crooning a Bollywood jingle in a tentative falsetto, began to nibble at the sugary donut like some tropical bird, swaying slightly to the rhythm of a song that he alone could follow.
This is a take on food in war that I found pretty unexpected. What's the story behind this?
Well, Najibullah, a gorgeous and a very troubled young man, a fighter, had been given to me by the warlord cum manager of a hotel where I was staying in Jalalabad near Tora Bora in 2001 when Osama bin Laden and about 1,000 al-Qaeda fighters and Taliban fighters were believed to be hiding in Tora Bora in the mountains. And I was basically told that in order to be able to report from the region, from the area, I had to hire Najibullah and pay not him but his commander $25 a day. I think it was a sort of another way of making money on journalists. And Najibullah turned out to be an absolutely amazing guide to so many things. First of all, this is a man, he was in his mid-20s. He had been fighting since he was 12. He was a portrait of an Afghan man who just found himself swept away by the conflicts that keep rolling across the Afghan mountains and plains there. And he fought against the Soviets, and then he fought against the Taliban, and now for a moment, he was out of work because American Special Forces had taken over the fight. Uh-huh. And he basically showed me what the life of the foot soldiers that American forces were using in Afghanistan to rout out the Taliban, what their lives were like. And because he smoked a lot of hashish, he had a bit of a sweet tooth. So he also introduced me to jalebi, which is, as I described, sort of Afghan donuts.
Yes. Yeah. And the idea of sugar and war, somehow that combination is just, it clashes in my mind. Sugar, the treat, and the life
sugar
that's
the
being
treat.
Led.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also, you know, cheap energy. And as I later found out, you know, there is also an alternative use of candy wraps. When a group of gunmen, whom I was also told to hire to accompany me on a very dangerous road, which we had dubbed the Death Road. You know, every country has the Death Road. When my five bodyguards turned their guns at me to demand more money, and I realized that they had wrapped the barrels of their Kalashnikovs with Hubba Bubba wrappers and Donald Duck stickers out of chewing gum packages and dum-dums. And I thought, really? I'm going to be killed by a gun that's screaming at me with yellow and pink and blue? And it was sort of surreal. But very, you know, wars are surreal.
That is utterly surreal. Are there any moments of sitting down at the table with people that really haunt you?
Well, first of all, an American Army colonel once told me that people who go through a war with you are a small fraternity. And being together with someone in extremity is a very strong bond. And sharing meal at the end of the day with people who, you know, people who work with me are risking their lives. And after I'm gone, they continue to risk their lives because that they live in a war zone. It's just they can't leave. Yeah. They don't have a place to go. And sharing a meal is one of the most elemental ways of expressing that sense that we're family. We're the closest of friends. We will, you know, if it comes to that, we will die in each other's arms. We will be the last people we see. And the meals differ so much. They vary so much. There were these amazing, lavish meals that looked like wedding feasts that Iraqi soldiers threw for a unit of American soldiers with which I was embedded in 2005. And then there was a pit stop I made in a small Afghan village in 2001. The village was about to starve because they had no food. They had no access to food. It had been a long, long drought. The nearest market town was 17 hours of on foot, and they had no cars. And I stopped by a little lean-to that served as a shop that just sold necessities, you know, soap and matches and olive oil. Mm-hmm. And the owner was just about to close the shop for the winter because there was absolutely no need for his wares, because if you don't have anything to cook with cooking oil, then who needs it?
Yeah.
And because I was passing through, he saw me as a guest, and so he automatically became the host. So he shared, you know, he didn't have any food either, but he shared with me what he could, and it was a fistful of these gnarled green, really dry raisins. And he sort of poured those raisins into my palm and apologized that he couldn't give me anything more. And these raisins, Lynn, were worth every single plate at that huge Iraqi table in an Iraqi army base. Because he was giving away, possibly a sustenance for a day, to me, a complete stranger. And these gestures are what makes, these gestures are what reminds me that we're human and reminds me that we're human even in the most dire circumstances.
Anna, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Anna Bodkin's book is Peace Meals. Now, you can find a recipe for that Afghan sweet jalebi on the website splendidtable.org. You know the drill. The day that the devil designed. Then you come home from work, you drop your keys, you open the fridge as your kids tug at your shirt, and as your spouse texts, traffic delays, and all you can think is, I cannot do this tonight. Well, Alana Chanilla knows the drill and feels your pain. She writes cookbooks and the blog Eating from the Ground Up. She specializes in making just about everything she can from scratch. But in her new book, The Homemade Kitchen, Recipes for Cooking with Pleasure, she takes a refreshingly realistic approach, encouraging readers, as one of her chapter's titles says, do your best and let it go. Our correspondent, Joe Yonan, talked with Alana about the book.
Hi, Alana. I'm so excited to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I'm so excited to be here.
So my favorite thing, I think, about your book is this collection of the phrases at the beginning, the ones that you organize your chapters around, the phrases that you have taped to your fridge, start where you are, do the work, invite people over, eat outside. Why do you have those on your fridge? What are you trying to remind yourself?
Oh, that's the big question. You know, I think that food means so much, you know, to all of us. We all have to eat. And I feel like every time I decide how to walk into the kitchen, what to eat, how to feed my family, I'm making a decision about how I want to live my life. And those phrases really help keep me on track. I think, you know, when I start to feel overwhelmed, when I start to feel resentful of the work of making dinner, you know, when I start to get too hard on myself or forget to find pleasure in dinner, those phrases have really been the thing that brings me back.
They're your mantras.
Exactly. You know, I grew up as a child of a single mom, you know, a hippie who always had Breathe on the fridge. And I feel like it's always good to have a few messages on the fridge just to keep you on track.
So what I find so refreshing really about your perspective is that you encourage people to not feel like things have to be perfect. That, you know, you do your best and let go. That's another one of your mantras.
Oh, my favorite one, yeah.
Can you explain more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, I think it just really isn't any place for perfection in home cooking, at least not in my home kitchen. There's so many places to see beautiful food around us these days. You know, cookbooks are more gorgeous than ever, and there's television, and then there's Instagram and Pinterest, and a lot of these tools are really inspirational and wonderful and, you know, provide all sorts of good lessons for the kitchen. But in the end, when we're just trying to get dinner out, the goal of the food that I'm cooking in my kitchen is to feed people. And if it does that marginally well, I think it's a success. And I find more and more that other people need to hear that too.
Especially parents, right?
Oh, yeah, especially parents. I mean, we could talk about picky kids all day. I get emails every day from parents who are saying, you know, my kid will only eat noodles and I feel like a terrible parent. And what do I do? And how do I get my kids inspired in the kitchen? And my advice is always to relax, to do your best. You know, put the food that you love out there on the table and know that nutrition is something that happens over a lifetime. And if you're enjoying the kitchen and enjoying food, you're modeling that for your kids. You know, it's the best we can do and it's enough. It's good.
So you make really many more things from scratch than the average bear. If you were to suggest a few places for people to start, things that you think can really make a difference, what would they be?
I suggest starting with yogurt because that's something that a lot of people eat and spend a lot of money on good yogurt, and it's so easy and rewarding to make. So definitely yogurt. And I also, you know, I'm a big preserved lemon person.
Oh God, of course.
You know, I always have a big jar of preserved lemons in my fridge and I use them in everything. Anything that sort of requires some lemon and some salt is made better by preserved lemon. So I put it in my chicken soup and I put it in my hummus, and I find them to be sort of a magical ingredient. I can kind of make anything really, really good with preserved lemon. Bit of a funkiness. It's a totally new flavor than the lemon and the salt that create them. It's a little bit like a really great cheese. And it's the thing that people will take a bite of whatever you've made and they'll be like, what is in this? This is amazing. You know, and you can keep your preserved lemons a secret, or you can send a jar home with them. And I feel the same way actually about creme fraiche, which is something I always make at home. And it's very inexpensive to make. And it's great on tacos. It's wonderful on dessert. It's more mellow and sweet than sour cream. And it's just really versatile. And I love having that around. And it's so easy to make at home.
Now, Alana, you write really wonderfully about saving food and food scraps and avoiding food waste. Can you tell us about some of your favorite ways to do that?
Oh, sure. I know being resourceful in the kitchen is something I kind of get a thrill out of, because I always feel like if I can save something that I would normally throw away, I kind of feel like I'm sticking it to the man, you know, like free food. So I love it. There's a little thrill in it for me. And so, of course, you know, I love at this time of year, I love to roast all my squash seeds and I'll toss them with spices and roast them in the oven. And I get an extra snack from every squash that I roast. And in the summer, here's a good one. I love to save all the hulls from my strawberries. So if I'm making strawberry jam and I just have a big pile of strawberry hulls, I will put them in a pitcher of water. I learned this one from a friend, and I couldn't tell what she was doing when we were actually making jam together. And she said, oh, you've never had strawberry hull water? And you have to taste it to really believe it. But it doesn't taste like strawberries. It just tastes fantastic. It's like super, super refreshing and wonderful. You know, there's so many tricks. I feel like our kitchens are filled with these treasures that then we throw away.
Now, you obviously love words in addition to food, by the way you write. So I'm curious who some of your favorite people to read are.
Oh, I love that question. Let's see. Well, I think my first favorite food writer was really Laurie Colwin, and I go back to her all the time. I love her novels, but her two food books, Home Cooking and More Home Cooking, are always on my desk, and I read little bits of them whenever I just need to hear her voice. I feel like she's the queen of imperfection and home cooking and keeping it beautiful, and I love everything that she wrote. Also, there's this food writer, and her name is Patience Gray. And a friend of mine gave me her book, Honey from a Weed, about 10 years ago. And he told me it was going to change everything for me. And it was pretty transformative.
People don't really know about her. She was British, right?
Yeah. And she wrote about her travels. She traveled all through Spain and Greece and Italy. And she wrote this book about the connection between the people she met and the food that they ate. And she just makes these amazing observations on those connections, which I just feel like it's something that has really inspired me towards looking at that, looking at how food affects how we live. And it's really funny, and the recipes are great. I'm often giving this book as a gift because, like you said, a lot of people haven't heard of her, and she's a really good one to read.
She's on my list. Thanks so much, Alana, for telling us about her and for coming in.
Oh, I've loved it. Thank you, Joe.
Alana Chernilla is the author of The Homemade Kitchen, Recipes for Cooking with Pleasure. Joe Yonan is the food editor of The Washington Post and author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. Well, Alana left us with a couple of sane family-friendly dishes, stuffed winter squash, and a classic that nobody can resist, popovers. And you can find them at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we're talking with you and a foraging philosopher. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Why don't you talk? It is time to turn to your calls. Get to us any way you can. Facebook, Twitter, pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. We've got Megan calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Megan, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm so excited to get through to you.
Well, I'm excited to have you here.
I have a dilemma here.
What's the dilemma?
About 5 years ago, I started taking over cooking the turkey for my family for Thanksgiving. And that's actually not the dilemma. It went so well that I'm saddled with that forever now. But this year, my family came to me and they said, make us some duck, too, for Thanksgiving.
I love
and
the two.
I have no idea. I know, right?
Yeah. In addition to the turkey, could we have duck? And by the way, could we have a little pheasant on the side?
Thankfully, they haven't gone that far. But I know that duck is, there's a thing about duck and fat, and there's a certain way to cook it so it's not too greasy or too dry, and I don't even know how to pick a good duck breast. So can you walk me through it, please?
Now, they want duck breasts?
I think so. I don't think they want to go the whole hog there.
All right, or the whole duck, yeah. Okay, so right. We've got, but oh, now the duck breast, this is going to be easy. The whole,
okay.
Yeah, because this is done in a skillet. And this is the kind of thing, ideally, you do kind of do it the last minute. But
right.
If you have everything else done ahead, and you know, the turkey has to rest, what, 20 minutes, maybe, mm-hmm. right? So you got leeway yep. time there. This is a lot like cooking a steak. The duck breast is usually served pretty close to rare. That's the great key. And the other great key, because otherwise it's like chewing rubber, is you don't make it well done. And the other thing you don't do is you don't cook it too fast. And you have to thin slice it.
kind of across the grain. And you know how if you look at a chicken breast, you can almost see that there are fibers that kind of run on an angle. Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing is true on the duck. And the idea is you always want to slice across those lines because that's what tenderizes it. Okay, so here's what you're going to do. You're going to take, way ahead of anybody arriving or whatever, you're going to take the duck breasts, you're going to poke holes in the skin because there's a layer of fat in that skin, all right? You're going to rub them with some black pepper and some fresh thyme or a bit of rosemary. You're going to do a rub garlic in there and a little olive oil, okay?
All right, I'm with you so far.
All right, okay. And then you're going to put them in the fridge. Just loosely cover them. And how many people are you serving?
Six.
Oh, this shouldn't be too bad. You do, I think, considering you have a whole turkey and you're going to thin slice these babies, I would say probably four of them would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
They are not cheap. So, you know, just tell people these are the little side snacks. You know, they're not.
Right.
This is never going to be the main event for your Thanksgiving, unless everybody wants to contribute. But what you want to do is get a couple of skillets really hot, skillets that are large enough that you can hold those duck breasts without them touching.
Okay.
Now, have a platter handy on the side. Mm-hmm. And what you're going to do is you're going to put a little bit of olive oil in the bottom of each one of those pans. Not a lot. It's just enough to get things going. And you're going to get them pretty hot. And then you're going to throw the duck breast in skin side down, flat, okay? Side by side, no touching. And you're going to let that sear for a minute or so that it's, the skin is already starting to crisp. And then you're going to take a spatula, like a pancake spatula, and you're going to run it under the breast so that you don't tear the skin, flip it over, sear it on the other side. And then what you'll do is you'll knock the heat down very low, and you're going to cook them for maybe 5 to 8 minutes. Do you have an instant reading meat thermometer by any chance?
Don't have an instant read, but I do have a meat thermometer.
I think an instant read is a worthy investment.
Okay.
Because what you want to do is you want to take the internal temperature at the center of that breast to about 130.
Okay.
And now this is medium rare. 130 to 135, because when you let it sit for a little bit, which it has to do before you slice it, it's going to raise about 5 degrees. So the idea is you're going to just brown it well on both sides, and then you're going to cook it until you reach that internal temperature, but you're going to cook it very slowly. That's what's going to keep it delicious and moist and juicy. And you're going to flip it every so often. Now, this is while you're sticking stuff in the oven and you're maybe even, you know, staring at the turkey saying, be perfect and all of that. And then once you get it to about 130, just flip it on the skin side, knock the heat up just to give it a final crispness. And then put it on a platter, the serving platter, and just let it rest. And then what you do, and you can even do this at the table, take a long, sharp knife and just thin slice it on an angle across those fibers or grains. Thin slice it, fan it out on the plate, and you are there.
Brilliant.
And salt it. And that's it.
Of course.
Yeah. Now, if you want to do a pan sauce, you just throw some red wine into that pan and scrape everything up and, you know, drizzle that over it if you want to do that.
That sounds good.
Yeah. It's really good. And you know what would be a good idea? Why don't you get one in advance and do a practice session with it?
Going to say that.
Oh, you see, too.
I got to do a practice run, no?
Yeah, and you'll have to eat it. I mean, what a tragedy.
I know.
Two great minds running along with the single thought. I love it. Hey, happy Thanksgiving.
That's the best compliment I've ever gotten.
Well, I'm very flattered as well. But seriously, have a great holiday. The families.
Thank you, Lynn.
You are welcome. They're going to feast. Take care.
Oh, I hope you do too. You too.
Thank you. It'd be a great idea to splurge and have duck breast for Thanksgiving. Boy, it's so good. It's so delicious. I mean, the flavor is so wonderful. And if you do that sear and then slow cook it, so it's not, you know, well done in a ring and then sort of reddish in the center, that it's all medium rare. It's just so beautiful. My mouth is watering. Anyway, you can reach us. You can go to Facebook, you can go to Twitter, and you can send us an email. You can go to splendidtable.org. Katie is calling from Ashland, Oregon. Katie, What is on your mind? Hi there. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about figs, Möbius quantities of figs.
Oh, boy. When we say Möbius, how many? What is a Möbius in terms of, are we talking bushels here? Or are we talking?
Well, we have this tree, this Black Mission fig tree, and we've only owned the home for a couple of years, and it has been producing 2 years in a row from June until October.
Oh.
And I just don't know what to do with them. I have to pick them, otherwise the bears come down and eat them.
Yeah, okay. We don't want bears. So,
no.
Okay, a couple of, you know what pops into my mind? I know I always end up going to Italy at first, but there's a wonderful tradition in Italy that when the figs come in, you know, and they ripen, they take the figs and they slit them in half. And they partially dry them, just spread them out on a screen. Now, you could do this in a very low oven, just
okay.
Partially dry them. Or they even leave them whole. And then what they do is a roasted almond and a bit of lemon rind or orange rind and a little sugar is mixed together. And the almond is pressed into the center of the fig.
Oh, that sounds really pretty.
It really is. And then you stand up the fig. Well, you can stand those up and you, again, put them in the lowest oven imaginable and let them dry a little bit more. Keep them in a place where there's lots of air around them. And then you can eat them that way. You can put them out with coffee. You can then, you know, put them on ice cream. What I did 1 year was I literally packed ice cream around it and froze them in coffee cups.
That's a great idea.
I slice them first. So that's one way to go. And following that theme, you can slit them in half and you can, you know, sprinkle a bit of port wine on them and rosemary and chopped onion and a slow bake until they're pretty much dried. And then that can go into stuffings. That can be poached in wine and served next to anything you cook.
That sounds wonderful. Thanksgiving, I love savory stuff.
Yeah, Thanksgiving turkey would be fabulous with that kind of thing. And that's another way to go. And then another way, which I do all the time, and in fact, I've got so many jars of this stuff I haven't gotten to use, I've really got to quit this year, which is I take rum or brandy, in so many words, some nice tasting alcohol. I make a little bit of sugar syrup with a vanilla bean in it. I put that all together, and then I take the figs, I quarter them, I have them, I put them in a sterilized jar and pour that alcohol over them and let them sit. And the alcohol becomes a liqueur or it goes into cakes or that kind of thing. And the figs can be eaten on their own or with cake or ice
cream.
Delicious. Yeah, really, really simple. And you can flavor that with spices and whatever. And it makes a very nice gift.
And it sounds simple.
Really simple. My idea of homemade gifts, simple.
Great.
Yeah, no work. So, I mean, there's just a few ideas. Obviously, you can freeze them. You can make fig ice cream. You can puree them, make fig cakes. All of that is wonderful. And the Mediterranean, if you go to the Mediterranean, any country, you're going to find things done with figs that are just wonderful.
But well, thank you so much.
Enjoy them.
I'm going to get to work right now.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You better hang up because you've got a lot to do.
All right. Take care, Lynn.
Take care, Katie. Bye.
Bye.
Remember, you can get to us anytime. You just call 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Alan Muscat is a wild foods educator. Now, he's based in Asheville, North Carolina. Many people call him the Mushroom Man. He calls himself a philosophorager. Now, 20 years ago, he founded No Taste Like Home, a nonprofit educational organization that offers forage-to-table events. Muscat is also the founder of a public wild foods education program. Now, its goal is to have every child in the United States be able to safely identify and harvest the 10 most common wild foods in their area. Well, producer Carla Seidel joined one of Muscat's foraging tours and brings us a taste of his philosophy.
Are you ready?
Yes.
I'm Alan Muscat. I'm a wild foods educator. I like to call myself a philosophorager. I have a philosophy degree. I hunted for restaurants for many years and sold. Now I just teach. I do tours, and mushrooms are my specialty, but I've diversified, and there's over 100 things I can show people here.
And there's a lot of these plants that we're passing are edible.
You know, foraging's increasing in popularity probably behind wild foods in general. It's familiar through the words local and sustainable, green. That's all true of wild foods, and I think it would be arguable for any other type of food.
What did you just dig up there, Nick?
I'm not totally sure, but I think that it might be wild ginger.
I've done ginger ale with it. I've made a root beer with it. And I've used it in, you know, curries and stuff like that.
Fresher food is shockingly more nutritious.
What it has is protein. That's why like a portobello will taste so meaty. Sometimes as much as meat or milk. Some mushrooms have more than others, but they all have minerals and vitamins.
It stands to reason that we are evolved to eat wild food. We're designed to eat it. We've been eating it for millions of years. And so people understand that GMOs, you know, and chemicals and things are unnatural, you know, frankenfoods. But they don't realize that genetic modification is thousands of years old. You know, the moment we started selecting so that we have eventually a big fat apple that is sweet and bland, not tough, not full of seeds, thin skin, shiny, all these things, they're selecting out the nutrition.
Jambalaya, catfish pie, filet gumbo. So sassafras leaves is what gumbo's made gummy with. And they should smell like what? What do they smell like? How about lemon or Fruit Loop cereal?
I grew up eating junk food and fast food. And I got sick based on not just the sugar roller coaster, but the roller coaster of stress that's endemic to civilization. Like, I've had a lot of anxiety. So that, you know, it's a physical manifestation, too, and a psychological one of growing up in this culture of struggle and fear and scarcity.
I don't know that any of these that we've seen so far are poisonous.
We call it scarcity.
Where, here? Those tiny ones? Okay, wait, there's a bunch here. See, it's hard to get anywhere when there's too many mushrooms. This is a wild garlic, so this tiny thing is a clove of garlic.
It's funny, it may sound counterintuitive because we have, you know, glut of junk, but we have a scarcity of time because we work so hard to live. And of course, we might do it to buy things, and we might have a lot of things, so it may not feel scarce. We have a scarcity of love, of connection, well, things that we naturally get. In a different, I'm not saying just American, but worldwide, what we call developed nations have an extremely scarce reality.
We didn't get to eat that.
Yeah, what's what we're doing right now? He's going to cook it for us.
Iron Chef, you heard of that show? They once had a mushroom episode, and the guy said, "The secret to good mushroom is never let them take a bath." Yeah, butter, salt, garlic. It's,
I mean, I've chosen to use the word home and the idea of it to name my whole business, No Taste Like Home. The mission is to engender a sense of home, to help people feel at home in this life. And that's not just in the woods. It's to be comfortable with nature, including human nature. Home is where you're surrounded by friends and family and you feel safe and provided for.
This is a very tender, perfect chicken of the woods. Okay, here it comes. You earned it. One bowl, family style. There's spoons, fingers, fighting.
Where's my bite?
You touched me so much.
Oh, good. It's really good. I like it. Wait,
I have a question for you.
That's what I think I'm experiencing more, and I would like to communicate through wild foods. This feeling that the Garden of Eden is real, and it's a choice we've made. We make every day to take what's freely given as a gift or to struggle to do it ourselves, to replace it with what we think is better.
That was forager Alan Muscat, founder of No Taste Like Home. Carla Seidel is an independent producer and multidisciplinary artist. Well, that's the show for this week. We'll be back next week. And until then, let me leave you with this from Thomas Carlyle. He said, "Nature alone is antique, and the oldest art a mushroom."
The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, if you love what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. And for a daily dose of food inspiration, make sure you're following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. Talk to you next week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.